The Bible provides but few details about the original observance of Rosh Hashanah. In the Torah, we're told simply that this day was a Shabbaton, a day of solemn rest, a Mikra Kodesh, a sacred assembly, and a Yom Terurah, sometimes a Zikaron Terurah, a phrase which is usually translated day on which the shofar is sounded. Now we can coax a little bit more understanding about the spirit of the first observance of Rosh Hashanah by translating this latter phrase quite literally, Yom Terurah, the day on which the Terurah call was sounded. The Terurah is the first of the four calls of the shofar, which we heard this evening. It's that single note, repeated short intervals frequently. It was the tocsin, the alarm call in ancient Israel. When an enemy approached the city, when there was fire within the city, the Terurah was sounded, and the community was mobilized to action by that call. Now, what has the alarm to do with Rosh Hashanah? Obviously, our ancestors in ancient Israel believed that there was some imminent danger associated with the new year. Wherein lay that danger? It lay in the new year itself. What virtue was there in sounding the alarm before the new year? After all, there's nothing we can do together as a community to change the natural catastrophes or the future that lies ahead. Why then was it sounded? The ancients believed that ritual and ceremony were not only, as we take them to be, colorful backgrounds for our meditation and our prayer, or the ceremonial symbols to be effective ways of calling to mind some important ideas about which we ought to be thinking at moments such as this. They thought as deeply as we did about, as we do about the elemental questions of life. But at the same time, they had an instrumental association of ritual and its effect. That is to say, they believed that through their observance and through their ritual, they could affect the gods or God. And one of their most common forms of ritual in the ancient world was to suggest by some earthly drama, in human terms, what it was you wanted the god to do for you. And so when there was drought in the land, the priest would pour water as a libation at the foot of the altar, in that way suggesting to God that the heavens might be opened up and that water should come down to replenish the earth. And similarly, when the community faced danger, it sounded the Terurah to mobilize its resources against whatever the danger might be. And so when the Terurah was sounded in the shrine, in the temple, in a sense it was a way of summoning God to help the people face some imminent danger, to help them face the new year. What did they fear about the new year? Well, being human, all of us prefer the known to the unknown. For the most part, we don't like to sail in uncharted waters. To be human is to have an imagination. And our imagination is a very active part of our mind, sometimes overactive. And although we often think of the good things that will happen in the new year, just as often, perhaps more frequently, we tend to see what's in the shadows of the year ahead, the perils, the dangers that we might face. It's interesting when you consider the great classics of the ancient world, how many of these classics involve an epic story of some hero and his companions setting out on a dangerous journey along which he somehow faces and overcomes personifications of all the fears that were shared by the people of his time. We fear the unknown. That's natural. And the ancients also believed that each year had a personality. And that though the past year might not have been the best of all possible years, at least we'd survived. We knew what its perils might be, and who knew how bad the new year might in fact be. Days had a character of their own, and if the days were evil, they felt there was really very little that the human could do to change the fate that lay ahead. And so they summoned God to their side. Now, if anthropologists were to describe this first Rosh Hashanah observance, they would label it simply an act of sympathetic magic, an attempt to manipulate God to the advantage of the worshiper. And our ancestors, the sages and the prophets, were quickly dissatisfied with the simplicity of this early form of the Rosh Hashanah. Three new calls were added to the alarm call. The theme of Rosh Hashanah was reshaped, redirected. It had been in its original state a Yom Torah, the day of the alarm. And now it became the Yom Hadin, the day of judgment. You know the image. It exists in all forms of worship that involve Rosh Hashanah. It exists throughout our folklore. On the New Year's Day, each of us, in turn, presumably, stands before the heavenly court. And there before God the judge is a book in which the heavenly scribes have inscribed the deeds of our life for good and for evil. And the record is read out, and a judgment is rendered. And according to that judgment, so will be our fate, presumably, in the year that is opening. And what this new theme suggests is that, in some basic way, our fate in the new year corresponds to our actions, to our deeds. We are not simply dependent upon the gods or the nature of the year for our fate. Some of it, at least, is within our own control. And so it is that as the new year begins, the basic drive of Rosh Hashanah is what's called Cheshbon HaNefesh, a form of spiritual self-examination. We are asked to see ourselves as we might appear before God, to see ourselves stripped of all of our rationalizations and justifications and all the explanations we've given ourselves for our compromises and for our failings and for our lethargy, to see ourselves clearly and truly and critically, and to make a judgment which will lead us to try to improve our lives, to establish new disciplines, to strengthen our character. It's a healthy undertaking. Now, of course, we do not control the future. There is no guarantee that if we are good and disciplined and work hard and are honorable, we'll be successful, or everything will work out the way we would like it. But surely it's true that if we're irascible or angry or arrogant, we can trample on and destroy some of the most elemental and central relationships of our lives. The very love relationship, the intimate relationships, which ought to give our lives their fundamental serenity. And it's equally true that by our greed, our naked ambition, we can destroy forever the possibility of having a good name in our community, of being able to stand for things which we believe to be important and our voice to be heard when we speak of those things. As a Yom Hadin, Rosh Hashanah becomes an inward-looking observance. We're not looking out to try to change God so much that we pray to God, Chadesh Aleinu Shana Tova, let the new year be a good year. That's only natural. But we try to see what it is that we can do, what it we can do about ourselves, which will allow the new year to be one of greater fulfillment, growth, of purposeful living for us. Now, of course, being human, we didn't completely let go of the original theme of the Rosh Hashanah observance. If you happen to go home tonight and pick up the Talmud for a bit of casual reading, you might discover in a section known as Harayot a description of what you might eat during the Rosh Hashanah. And what is suggested there is that you eat pumpkin seeds and dates. Now, why should you eat pumpkin seeds and dates, the sages asked of the man who brought forth this suggestion? Because they are fruits that grow in great profusion. There are a lot of them. And they're a sign of prosperity. And then you sense a silence in the text, as if the disciples were looking at their master rather askance. This is superstition. And the master answers, Simana miltahi. There are those who say that perhaps we ought to give some credit to omens. And tonight, at our table, what did we have? The slices of apple, which we dipped in the honey, that the year might be a sweet year and a good year for us. And though, of course, none of us believes that God is suggestible, we dip the apples in the honey in the hope that the new year would in fact be a sweet and good year for all of us. Now, when one considers the origins of Rosh Hashanah and follows along in the development of the holiday, you're struck not only by the changes in ritual and liturgy and observance, but by the changing mood that we brought, that our ancestors brought to each of the holidays. Of course, we've come in our lives, each of us, in different moods to Rosh Hashanah. Sometimes we're exultant. The world seems to be opening up before us. Sometimes the world weighs heavily on our shoulders. Sometimes we're filled with anxiety. There's illness. There's age. We're facing problems whose solution seems to escape us. Individually, we come to Rosh Hashanah in very different moods from year to year. But it's interesting that there is a kind of collective spirit which typifies a given age and explains a great deal of the meaning of Rosh Hashanah to the people of the time. In the early 19th century, a German philosopher named Hegel put forward the thesis that in every age there is a cultural environment which conditions the people of the time and which determines to a very large extent the shape of their responses to the elemental questions of the time, how they will organize their society, in what they will have faith, what they will describe as righteous living and what will seem sinful and wrong to them. Hegel was arguing with those of an earlier age who insisted that there was a single human nature and that human beings of all ages, in all situations, in all cultures, responded in essentially the same way to the challenges and opportunities of their time. Now, there is an elemental nature which is human. We are creatures of instinct. We are creatures of potential. But Hegel is certainly right, as the historians have proven over and over again, that our responses to the opportunities and to the challenges and to the pressures of our time, what we believe to be right and what we believe to be wrong, what we believe to be appropriate and what seems to us totally inappropriate, is to a very large degree shaped by the culture, which is a culture of our community, with this culture of our age. And when you look at what Hegel called the zeitgeist, the spirit of the time, as it affects the responses of Jews to Rosh Hashanah, you look back over history, it appears that there are three basic moods in which our people have come to this holiday observance. The first and original mood and the longest lived, it begins in biblical times, it lasts down as long as rabbinic Judaism held sway. It's a mood which is characterized by the phrase which was in our liturgy this evening, weeping may tarry for the night, but with the morning cometh the joy. Our fathers, grandfathers, and their fathers did not have a great faith that the coming year would be very much different than the year that had just passed. They lived on the margin of existence. Their lives were surrounded by political oppression, by danger. Their lives were brief and often bruising. And they had no reason to believe that the new year would be fundamentally very different from the year that had been before. And so the wisdom which they tried to teach to their children is the wisdom which is spoken in the book of Proverbs. Be not too eager about tomorrow, for you do not know what the new day may bring. What was it then that allowed our fathers over the long centuries to stay steady? What allowed them to keep trying to build decent homes and a good society? What gave them the courage to continue to face up to the blows of life? And the answer is this. Though they had little faith that the new year might be a different year than the one past, though they prayed to God, as we do, L'shana tova, tikatevu, maybe we'd be inscribed for a good year. They had a certain, clear, and unshakable faith in God the Redeemer, that there would be a time, it might be long distant, but it would certainly come, when the evils of the world would be overturned, when Israel would be returned from exile, when the nation would be redeemed, would be sovereign on its own soil, and when all of the problems of mankind would be resolved. And it shall come to pass when, in the end of days, the prophet said, that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established as the top of the mountains, where they shall beat their swords into plowshares, their spears into pruning hooks, but nations shall not make war against nation anymore. The long hope, the sustaining hope in God the Redeemer, this was the vision that allowed our fathers and our mothers in the ages past to face the difficult problems, the dangers, the anxieties of their day with a measure of confidence, and to live with a measure of effect. And then about 200 years ago, as Jews began to move into the European society, as the ghetto and the shtetl were left behind, and suddenly a brave new world opened up to the Jew began to sense possibility. He began to think that the new year might be, in fact, different in nature than the year that had just passed. And he entered Europe, this world of new vistas, precisely at a time when Europe itself was undergoing a mood of exuberant optimism, as Europe was beginning to feel the first effects of the Industrial Revolution, of the Age of Reason. Man was creating through science and technology machines which could harness the powers of nature. For the first time, there seemed to be a chance to free man from the burden of back-breaking, mind-dulling work, to allow him some leisure, to allow him to develop the spirit, to allow man to live with some dignity. Life had been brief, and as medicine learned some real skills, the lifespan began to increase, and men and women were healthier. Childbirth ceased to be a dangerous undertaking. The world seemed to be getting better, and because there were more goods and there was more prosperity, the people who had privilege did not have to fight as hard to maintain their privilege. And so the idea of that men had and women had rights, and that these rights could be extended across the whole society, began to have some measure of realism, and men began to hope that it would not be long before a new world would emerge. Tomorrow was bright. If not tomorrow, the day after tomorrow. And so as the old Jews had said, in the end of time, God will, the new Jew began to say, in our time, and if not in my time, in my children's time, we will. We will, through the work of our hands and through the fruit of our minds, through our science and our research, through our laboratories and our libraries, we will shape, engineer, create a new world. The old rabbis had spoken of man as a partner with God in the work of creation. And the new group of spiritual leaders began to think that man might in fact be the senior partner in that arrangement. And people began to think that perhaps the old hope of a miraculous supernatural intervention at a time in the future when all God would make all right was in fact a kind of self-delusion, understandable because people need to hope, but nevertheless an illusion which ought to be set aside and forgotten. We would create, we would establish through our efforts peace, freedom, and justice would be established in the earth. It was an exultant time, a happy time, and a remarkably short-lived period. It ended for us at Auschwitz. It ended for us when we recognized that if man be God, God is a devil god. It ended for us at Hiroshima. We recognized that the science which we had hoped would be to man's good could also be turned to our destruction, to evil. Whereas our fathers or grandfathers had believed that science would be the savior, we now began to think of science as the sorcerer's apprentice, as much a source of danger, a threat, a curse, as a blessing. To our fathers, tomorrow would be a bright new day. To us, tomorrow is the day after, a nightmare image of a lifeless world. We're in a strangely unfortunate generation. In many ways, science made good on its promise. Even those who have the least among us are comfortable in a way that other generations could hardly credit. We have a great deal. Our world enjoys a great deal. More people are employed, more people have enough to survive with some measure of decency today than existed in the world 100 years ago. In many ways, science has made good on the hopes that our grandparents invested in it. But in so many other ways, we live under threat. We live with a sense of danger. We've learned again that material prosperity is not enough. It is no guarantee of happiness. And so, we live under a shadow. And some of us who are understandably concerned and disturbed, as are all of us, but who sense more imminently, perhaps because they are more sensitive, that the doom is impending, that there may be only a few years for mankind somehow to take himself in hand and right the wrongs which create the tensions of our day. Some of us have become desperate. And a kind of thinking which many felt had gone out years and years ago when people still believed that there would be a judgment day, that the world was doomed, is again in force, apocalyptic thinking. There are among us sensitive souls who are convinced that by 1990, perhaps by the year 2000, someone will press the button for certain, or the bombs will go off because there'll be a malfunction, an accidental malfunction in the computer system itself, and our life as we know it will be forever destroyed. And these sensitive souls, moved by frustration, moved by anxiety into a frenzy of activity, using their God-given imaginations, propose to us that we must completely transform the social order in the briefest period of time, that we must get beyond the nation state into some kind of world community, that we must completely eliminate all armaments, that we must replace those who are in power with others who will be more sensitive, more aware of the needs of the future. And however much we may share the fears and sympathize with their concerns, most of us recognize that this is not the way. It is not the way because it is an impossible way. The human being is a creature of habit. We do not easily change and exchange our habits. We have only to look about ourselves in the world to see how many nations, how many cultures are pulling back from modernity rather than seeking to work through it to some new arrangement. The problem with this kind of concern, this kind of frenzied commitment, is that it ultimately leads to despair and to frustration and to programs of action which are not only self-defeating but can often trigger the very thing that is feared. Look about at our world. Look at those men who became in our own day the great liberating heroes of their communities, who liberated their country or their tribe from colonialism. Men of vision, men of a dream, men of an urgent dream, so urgent, in fact, that when they came to power in country after country, they were determined to impose the dream upon a people not yet ready for it, and they became tyrants. Tyrants of the very people they had freed. And in order to achieve their dream, they imprisoned, and they killed, and they destroyed the very opportunity which lay at the base of their country's future. I have a strange nightmare image sometime of some of those who are so desperate to achieve the very thing we all wish for, the elimination of nuclear weapons, that they attempt nuclear blackmail in order to achieve the destruction of the nuclear weapons. They use the nuclear weapons in order to achieve their destruction. Fear leads to frenzy, leads to a loss of balance. And however much we sympathize and share those fears, the wise recognize that some other way is the only way that we can reasonably go. The frustrations and fears of our time are manifest in other ways as well. Fear leads to frenzy, and fear leads to fatigue. As I spoke with some of you as we approached these holidays, I heard again and again some of you say, I know Rosh Hashanah is coming, but I really am not in the mood. And I think what you were saying to me was this: I really don't want to think about the future, about its problems. I spoke some weeks ago to a group about the elections that were taking place in Israel. And after the talk, there was a question-answer period, and one man got up. I know him well, he's strong and capable and tanned. He said to me, you know, Israel seems so besieged and weighted with problems. The old problems don't disappear. The new problems seem to be piled on the old endlessly. There are, of course, the Arabs and their hate. There's the occupation of the Lebanon. There's the problem of the settlements in the West Bank. There's runaway inflation. There's the balance of trade problem. There are the religious divisions in the country. When will it end? And he ended with a telling phrase. He said, I'm tired. Now, this man lives in Cleveland. Neither he nor his sons are called up periodically to defend the security of Israel. He shares the prosperity that we share, and not the economic stringencies of Israel. But he's tired. And many of us are reacting out of fatigue and tiredness. We don't want really to think about the problems of our day. When someone begins to talk seriously about the problems, we divert the conversation to lighter channels. We read the light, the trivial, rather than the serious. Our problems are so incredibly complex that they seem to be overwhelming. And it's easier to think of other things than to try to deal with that complexity. We know that we ought to be doing something to improve the economies of the poorer countries. But if we give them money and they establish industry, their industry will inevitably limit the resources of the world, pollute the environment, create acid rain, destroy part of the ozone layer. And for their industry to be successful, it must undersell and outproduce ours. And so our very gift becomes a means of decreasing unemployment, increasing the economic problems of our own nation. The problems which we face on our shrunken globe are so interconnected and so complex that it's easier to avoid thinking about them than to think about them. We become tired before we've even tried. Europe became overwhelmed with a sense of the tragic nature of life long before we did here. Europe became oppressed by the sense of the tragic after the First World War, that most tragic and pointless bloodletting of the century. And in Europe after the First World War, some of the best and the brightest were wont to say, whenever someone said to them, come, join with me in this civic undertaking, come, let's see that this man of worth is elected to the parliament. I'm not political. I'm not political. The best and the brightest wanted to separate their lives out from the ugliness of politics, from the thanklessness of the political arena, from these kinds of concern, and to be allowed to lead out their private lives, to work at their profession, to teach their classes, to write their books, to do what they were allowed, what they did best, without being concerned with the other issues in the social order. And of course, because many of the best and brightest in Germany were not political, the worst in Germany was allowed to come into power. And you know, we're Americans are not giving to make these kinds of pronouncements about how we divide up our lives. But if truth be told, many of us are saying by the way we organize our lives, I'm not political. I'll do my thing. I work hard at my profession. I try to stay at top of it, of the knowledge that I must have for my daily work. I'm concerned with my family, but I don't want to be involved in what I cannot, in any case, do much about. The ultimate rationalization for us today is this. There are 4 billion Earthlings. I'm one. What difference does it make if I do nothing? But of course, a decision to do nothing is also a political decision. If you're doing nothing, someone else is doing something. And far better your something than his or her concerns or purposes. Some of us are frenzied, fearful. Others of us are fatigued and fearful. All of us are anxious. Even when we tried to push away from ourselves the sense of impending doom. And so in a very real sense, the problems which we must deal with are at base problems which arise from a crisis of faith. We, unlike our ancestors, most of us are not really sure on what we can depend for encouragement. Where lies our hope? The modern world destroyed for us the sense that there would be some supernatural being come down from heaven to suddenly make the world right. The Holocaust destroyed for us the sense that with confidence we could look forward to our own achievement of the brave new world for which we pray. Wherein lies our hope? Now, since we are a generation where hope is hard to find, I obviously can't draw upon the conventional wisdom to lay before you what you already believe. All I can do tonight is to speak to you personally of the sources of my own hope for the future. And I speak without any sense of confidence that we will avoid disaster. No one can guarantee that. I speak only of the fact that it is possible to lead a life of confident concern, a life that is active and responsible, even in this most anxious of times. And I find my source of encouragement and hope right here, in a service such as this, in a congregation such as this. Why are you here? Some of you have come out of tradition. Some of you become because the holidays are traditional rally of the family. Some of you have come perhaps out of a sense of ought or of guilt. But I suspect that at base, each and every one of you is here in some measure because there's something which within you which cries out to touch the sacred, which seeks the holy moment. There is something of the God, of the good within you, which cries out for expression, which cries out for reinforcement, which cries out for its being for shape, for direction. You've come here for encouragement because you sense within yourself something very positive, something very sensitive, something far nobler than perhaps you would have cared to admit to yourself. In the sense that we have all come together out of the same, rather inchoate, but nonetheless real sense that we are capable of more, that we can allow, that we are truly sensitive human beings, even though we live in a very difficult and troubled and tense world. That sense, some would call it our humanity. I would call it the divinity which is within us. Whatever we call it, that sense crying out, reaching out for the sacred, for God, is it not some reason for all of us to have confidence? We're not alone. We're not the only one who cares. Each and every human being here tonight, or whatever be his culture or his form of worship, unless he be mentally ill, each and every human being has within him something of that same innate divinity, that innate humanity, which cries out for a better world, which cries out for peace and for justice and for decency, for dignity, and all the things for which mankind prays. And here tonight, we're not the only ones who are here. All the generations that have been before us are with us. Our service is a collection of the best of the wisdom of our people about this holiday. And we think tonight of all the generations who have observed Rosh Hashanah in the years past, the dangers that they faced, the tensions that were part of their lives, and their courage, their willingness to stand firm, their faith in God, their faith in the right. They were not saints. We're not saints. But they tried, and they created this, an ultimately civilized moment. They created this, a moment of shared expression of the sacred which is within the human. They created this, the encouragement, the hope, which we all cry out for, which we all so desperately need. When our ancestors were asked, "Where is God?" their answer was, "God is wherever you let him in." Now, why do we have problems letting God in? In part because we're afraid of allowing the decency to fully express itself. To a large degree, we're afraid of the sacred and the holy. We might not be able to be as driven, as ambitious, as we are if we truly listen to the spirit that lies within. But it's there, crying out to be heard. It's that which gives hope to us that we can transform our lives, improve them. It's what lies within and allows us to feel that mankind can somehow come together and do what it can to face the problems of the day. It's interesting that when the Rosh Hashanah service was finally shaped, the one call, the truah, the alarm, had added to it three other calls. The tekiah, the single note which has begun low and ends up high, which was the call which was the call of the shrine in ancient Israel, the call to one's religious concerns, and the shevarim, The very word means broken. It's the wavering call which speaks of our inability to live up to our own expectations of ourselves. And finally, the Tekiah Gedolah, the great high sustained call. And in the traditional service, the alarm, the teruah, the call to action, the call to our better selves, the Tekiah, and the broken call, the call of our occasional failures and contrition, the shvarim, are repeated 99 times before the single great sustained call of hope, the call of the Tekiah Gedolah. What I'm saying is simply this. No one can guarantee us that doomsday may not come. No one can guarantee us that the complex problems of our world will yield to solutions which will resolve all their difficulties. There are no guarantees. Mankind has listened to the alarm and responded many times before, and will respond many more times before the final hope which we dare hardly express. But we have reason to hope. We are that reason. We are that reason because God made it so. So God is also the reason. And surely this much is true. That only if we keep our wits about us, only if we do what needs to be done, is there any hope for our world. But why then, Rabbi, don't we all suddenly become political activists? Why don't we all suddenly become politicians rushing out to save the world? The rabbi said that when we come to the heavenly gates, the guardian angel will not ask us, were you Moses? But were you Daniel Silver? Were you Zusya, is the way they phrase it. Did you do what was in your power to do? We're not asked to be the liberator of our people. That's given to few. We're not asked to be a great lawgiver. That's also not a common occurrence. We're asked to do what we do best, provided what we do is for the common good. To teach, to heal, to raise children, to encourage them, to love them so that they in turn can become competent and thoughtful adults and not people who have to spill out their own inner violence upon their society. In measure as we love and as we care and as we share and as we work with the institutions of support in our community, in measure as we offer ourselves to the common good, just in that measure are we the peacemakers. Are we the hope makers of our world? Some men, some women, will have to be those who negotiate the arms agreement. Some will have to be the leaders who teach their societies a vision larger than narrow visions which now imprison them. For some of you, that may be your appointed role in life. But all of us have a role. All of us have responsibilities. Because society's future does not depend simply on some political arrangement. Politics does not occur in a vacuum. There will be no peace if the individuals within the society are at war with themselves, so angry that they take out their anger on others. And so the message of the shofar tonight, the message of Rosh Hashanah, is a message of controlled hope. It's a message to look at yourself, sense the good within, sense the possibilities that you represent, to recognize that you are not unique, that those who are next to you share those same hopes, have that same possibility. We are part of humanity. That to be human is to have this sense, this possibility, the divine within. Best evidence I know that there is some hope for mankind sitting before me is here in this holy place. Amen.